Knives, machetes, saws, and shears, multi-tools, shovels, swords, axes, spears, hatchets, and tomahawks. If it cuts, snips, slices, or chops, Midway USA has it. Find great gift ideas in our huge selection of pocket knives and other everyday carry folding knives. Make a statement or create a family legacy with one of our top-of-the-line hunting knives. We've got a great selection of manual and electric sharpeners, too. For just about everything for the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized, and with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com, that's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Hi, everybody. It's Doc from the John Freaking Mirror Pod, and I want to let you know about our new website on WordPress. Take a few minutes and check it out. You'll be able to find pictures of the pod's guests, links to the podcast and social media accounts, ways to support the pod, how to get in touch, and our entire back catalog is there, including episode summaries. Missed these sections of the JMT episodes? You can find them there. Missed a Triple Crowner episode? Yep, that's there too. World travelers, adventure athletes, polar explorers, Barkley Marathon competitors, authors, filmmakers, documentarians, and more are waiting for you. Take a look at the new website, and just a reminder, adventure lives here.
What's behind you doesn't matter. Enzo Ferrari.
The real story about this race is that the eastern portion is just so much harder than the west. Like, you think the west is going to be hard because there are all these mountain passes and climbs, but the east is just like choppy up and down, kind of like the Appalachian Trail. Like, it's just like punchy and hard, relentless. But then that's actually when I kind of came into, you know, like what I can actually do. Like, I'm a great climber. That's what I can do. You know, this road riding, flat terrain, it was horrible for me, but I could climb. So then I'm catching this guy, and then I realize, like, okay, well, I have to start cutting sleep to actually try to make it go to catch him. So then, like, three nights out, I sleep, you know, 2.5 hours. Two nights out, I sleep another 2.5 hours. The final night, I sleep like 20 minutes and then another 10 minutes. And I'm like, I'm going to catch him. And then I'm riding along, you know, the middle of the night. Evan had fallen asleep, so he had, on a descent, he had had to stop and go to a hotel, which sucked because I wish we were together for that. But then I'm gaining, you know, ground, and then I see this light coming back towards me. And I was like, whoa, who is that? 3 a.m. And it was, and then I see this guy with like a bike and all the gear, and I was like, what is that, like a fan or what? But when he sees me, he turns around and starts riding with me. And I turn and look at him, and he's like, what's your name? And he told me, Stefan. And then I realized that's the guy I'd been chasing. And he had been so out of it that he had woken up and started riding backwards. He rode like, you know, over 4,000 mile race. He woke up, started riding backwards. I think we rode like 10 miles back. and then saw me and then started riding the right way. And then he told me his name, and then I was just like, I just took off, and then I'm just sprinting like crazy.
I'm Doc, and this is the John Freakin' Muir Pod.
Welcome to the John Freakin' Muir Pod. Lace up those boots and sling on the pack for a romp through trails, short and long. With your host and Renaissance man, Doc, it's time to embrace the suck.
From the backcountry to the backyard, we believe everyone deserves the highest level of protection. Since 1984, Sawyer Products offers the best, most technologically advanced solutions for protection against sun, bugs, and water, using time-released liposome technology, topical insect repellents, and new standards in water filtration. And with every Sawyer product you buy, you are helping to provide clean water through 140 charities in 80 countries with their long-lasting water filters. Every Sawyer product you buy is an investment in our common humanity. Choose Sawyer and keep the adventure going, knowing that their products have been tested and chosen by those who count on serious protection on the trail all day long. Want to make a podcast? Spotify's got a platform that lets you make one super easily, then distribute it everywhere, and even earn money, all in one place for free. It's called Spotify for Podcasters, and here's how it works. Spotify for Podcasters lets you record and edit podcasts right from your phone or computer. So no matter what your setup is like, you can start creating today. Then you can distribute your podcast to Spotify and everywhere else podcasts are heard. Video podcasts are also available on Spotify. With Spotify for Podcasters, you can earn money in a variety of ways, including ads and podcast subscriptions. And best of all, it's totally free with no catch. Since I discovered Spotify for Podcasters, I feel like my creativity has raised to another level. I highly recommend you give it a try. Download the Spotify for Podcasters app or go to www.spotify.com/podcasters to get started. And welcome back to another week on the trail with the John Freakin' Muir Pod. This week, we've got a real treat for our listeners. Now, I've talked to a number of endurance athletes on the pod, including multidisciplined adventure athletes, adventure racers, fast packers, and guys who run 240 miles at a time. But my guest this week may be the biggest badass of them all. I would like to welcome ultra endurance bike racer, Lael Wilcox, to the pod. Welcome, Lael.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Lael, you've been called the fastest ultra endurance racer in the world by Bicycling Magazine. And you've raced in multiple long distance events across the world, even creating some of your own races and routes yourself. Can you define for our listeners ultra endurance bicycle racing and tell us how you got involved in it? Because I think you came into it relatively recently, right?
Yeah, I started racing in self-supported racing in 2015. So the special thing about the racing that I do is that it's a continuous clock. So everybody starts together and whoever gets to the finish first wins. And that could be 100 miles or 4,000 miles or longer. And then it's self-supported. So that means you have to carry everything you need along the way. You can always stop at stores or restaurants or hotels, but those are services allowed for the public. So they're kind of neutral ground, but you can't have like a support vehicle or anybody meet you along the way to help you. Before I was racing, I was just touring on the bike, traveling the world. And during a trip, I entered my first race and I had no idea what I could do. And I just had so much fun out there. And I realized that this was something that was exciting for me and also something I was really good at. So I just continued from there. And that was April 2015. So since then, I've been doing a mixture of racing, traveling, and then I also host a girls mentorship program and women's scholarships and really anything I can do to kind of encourage more people to try this, see what's out there, and especially women. And then also just pursue my own dreams. So I feel like, you know, I'm usually not planning more than 6 months in advance, but that brings me all over the world to do just different fun things.
That is incredible. Now, did you misspeak right there? Did you say 4,000 miles?
Yeah, so the longest race I entered was the Trans Am. So 4,200 miles from Astoria, Oregon to Yorktown, Virginia. And that was self-supported. It was a road race. I'd never, you know, there's all these different kinds of riding. There's road, there's mountain, there's gravel, there's, you know, time trial. And the cool thing about this style of racing, the self-supported bikepacking, is that there are different kinds of races, but everybody really just tries all of them because it's like, well, why not? It's there. And then, you know, a race that long, the terrain's going to change along the way. So yeah, that was my longest race. And I actually outright won it in 2016. It took me 18 days, 10 minutes. I averaged 237 miles a day. I slept most nights about 5 hours, and I traveled through, you know, a lot of rural America. I mean, the cool thing about that race is it's based on the oldest bike touring route in the U.S. So it's the Trans Am bike route made by Adventure Cycling, established in 1976. So the year that I raced it was the 40th anniversary of the route. And in 76, it had been 2,000 to 4,000 young people had started together to ride the route, just to tour it, you know, and old bikes, just as this, it was like to inaugurate the bicentennial. They called it the bike centennial. And they all went out to ride this together. And, you know, at that time, it's like, how did people even coordinate to meet up for that? It was all through the mail. They're like, hey, let's do this. You know, this is going to be a big deal. And they did. And then I went back 40 years later to enter a race on it. Another guy established a race, I think, 3 years before. And then I just so happened to do it that year. And after winning the race, I went back to this big celebration for the route and got to meet people that had been on the original tour. And they are now like, you know, 60s, 70s. And then they're talking about their adventure 40 years ago and how different that was from mine. I mean, I think they took like 4 months to ride it, and I rode it in 18 days.
Wow.
But different, you know, different approach. And I mean, that's an adventure itself too. You're living on that route for that long. Speed doesn't make it better. It just makes it different.
Right.
But yeah, what a way to see the country, you know. And that summer it was a heat wave. I would check and half the days hit 106 degrees. I was just dying out there. It was so hot. This was in June. So
yeah. Don't give too much away, because that's one of our discussion points. Later. We're going to drill down into that 2016 Trans Am race and get into the nitty gritty of that. That sounds like an incredible experience. Now, before we get too far down the trail, Lael, I want to give you a warning about a regular feature we have on the pod. It's called the Pro Tip Insight of the Week. So we've got an audience listening to us who are interested in long distance backpacking, adventures, different types of epic experiences out there. And so what I'm going to do at the end of the episode, I'm going to turn to you and say, okay, Lael, what is your pro tip insight of the week? What can you share with our listeners to make their next adventure that much better? Mm-hmm. All right. So don't be surprised.
Okay.
It might, you know, just the idea might pop up during our conversation in terms of what you're going to share. So keep that in mind. Keep on the lookout for the pro tip. All right. So let's back up a little bit and talk about where you grew up, what your background is, what interested you have growing up. Were you a biker early on? And just, you know, how you got to where you are right now?
Oh, sure. No, I wasn't a biker. I was my first love in sports was basketball and then soccer. And then I was obsessed with soccer all through high school. I got into running, and that was kind of like my change from team sport to solo. But I never saw biking as a sport. It was just transportation. So that, you know, what started, I mean, I really didn't start riding until college, and I started riding just to commute to and from work. And then, riding around town. At that point, I was living in Tacoma, Washington, going to college, and I had to ride 4 miles to a job at a brewery, and that was just too far to walk. So I've never owned a car. I don't know how to drive. I used to walk everywhere. So then the bike was like my step up to having like a vehicle, you know, and then I was like, wow, I can go so much farther. It's so much faster. So that's how I got into it. But I never really thought about competing. I mean, it's just not really much of a competitive sport in the U.S., at least, especially not for me growing up in Alaska. You know, every kid learns how to ride a bike pretty much, but beyond that, you don't really, and I think every kid loves to do it, but you don't really think like this is something I could dedicate my life to. And I never expected to be doing this, but I'm so happy I found it later. And I think that's good too, because I never like went through a burnout phase. I wasn't like so driven that it was like it got old. It's like every day I get to ride, I'm happy about that. And whether it's competition or long distance or short distance, it's like, it's just such a relief to be out there. So fun. So that's kind of how I got into it.
So did I hear you correctly earlier? You said 2015, you entered a race for your first time?
Yeah. So I started riding probably in 2006. Like I learned how to ride, but I actually started riding to work in 2006 and then started traveling on the bike in 2008. And then I spent the next 7 years working half the year in restaurants to save money to spend the other half of the year traveling. And that started on roads in the US and then down into Baja in Mexico and then in through Europe and then to South Africa and the Middle East and basically anywhere like that seemed like a good place to go with a cheap plane ticket and a good season. That's where I wanted to go. And then along the way, realized that I liked riding dirt roads better than paved roads, just less traffic, more interesting places. And then finding those roads or finding those routes, I found that riding, bikepacking, race routes where like some local had set a route that's like, you know, 1,000 K or 1,000 miles, and then you follow it for the race. It's like, usually those are, you can find those online. So that was a great way to explore a place just at a touring pace, not in the race, but just to have like a special route. So then I was riding one of these routes in Israel, the Holy Land Challenge. And then I realized I was actually going to be still be in the country when the race was happening in April, 2015. And then I thought, well, the race is happening, I should just enter and see how it goes. You know, I'm already here. I've already ridden the route. I really like it. I'd like to ride it again, you know, so I'll just show up for the start. And so that's what I did. And I just had my touring set up. It's like a, you know, $400 steel mountain bike and, you know, my travel stuff, running shoes, platform pedals, cotton t-shirt, you know, I was the only woman that started. And I think it was like the third year of the race. And, you know, all these guys just thought I was a joke. They had all this fancy equipment and, you know, they're so serious and they had a plan and I was just there, you know, goofing off. And they're like, one guy's like, are you going to even finish the first day? And I was like, well, I don't really know, but I think I can, you know, I was like, I've ridden it. I like it. And so then that day I rode 145 miles and throughout the day, you know, there are these guys ahead of me. And then into the night, I just kept riding. And then, you know, I rode till 3 a.m. And then, you know, I found out later that I was at, when I stopped, I was 25 miles ahead of the second place guy. You know, I was like well ahead of the full field. Mm-hmm. And then I sleep for 3 hours and then I wake up and I just keep going. And I was like feeling great. And, you know, all these Israelis were like, what is happening? How is she doing that? You know, it's like, this is just impossible. So then like locals started coming to find me on the trail because I had a little tracker so they could come see. They like wanted to see if I was actually real. They're like, this is insane because like women aren't really athletic there. Like they just, you know, they mountain bike a little bit, but they're not really like competitive. They're not obviously not entering the race. They're not taking on this huge challenge. And so I think that was like so exciting just because I didn't know what I was capable of. And then to do it in a place where it's like, you know, women aren't in sports, that even meant more. But at that time I was like, okay, well, this is kind of a test because if I like this, then I'll go back. I'm going to fly back home to Alaska and I've got just enough time to get my gear together and ride through Alaska, through Canada, down to Banff, Alberta, to the start of the Tour Divide. because the Tour Divide is based on the Great Divide mountain bike route from Canada to Mexico. And it's a route that I had toured before. And I was like, well, if I'm actually good at this racing, that's the race I want to do. You know, it's like goes all the way through the Rockies, and like, and I like the terrain, and I just want to see how I could do so. And to ride to the start from Alaska, that's adding on another 2,100 miles, you know? So that's what I did.
So back to the race in Israel, where did you finish the race?
I did. And you know, it got a little messed up because, I think 2-3 days into the race, I was far in the lead, and then it poured rain. And then, the soil there has so much clay in it that it just turns into this crazy, crazy mud, which is like the enemy of bikers.
Yeah,
mud in like desert, because it like just gums to your wheels and stops your wheels from spinning. So you can't spin the wheels can't spin anymore. You definitely can't ride. You can't even push your bike. You have to carry it on your shoulder, and then you're stomping through mud, and then mud is just caking your shoes. And then it's just kind of this death march, you know, where you're going like a mile an hour and working so hard. Mm-hmm. So this happened, but I was still like, well, I'm still in the race. I'm still doing it. So I kept going. And then, well, I mean, like my final night out there, I didn't have like a tent or a real bivy. I just had this emergency bivy, and it's pouring rain. I slept under a tree, on like an incline of a hill. And then I was like using the tree to like stay, or using the base of the tree to like kind of push myself up. And I slept there. And then I got up in the morning and I kept going, you know, trudging. And then finally to like kind of a sandier area. And then I like keep going up to this town, and it was raining so much that the river that was in between me and the town was flooded, and I had to cross it like no bridge. And I crossed it, and I actually like the current like pulled me under, and I almost lost my bike, but I grabbed it and I kept
this,
it. And
this
I stopped
is, this
it.
Is starting to sound like a through hike. This is starting to sound
exactly.
like, you know, PCT.
I mean, like it gets, you know, it's like the weather changes, things change. And right. So I actually made it to the town. And then I stopped this bakery, and I'm like kind of, you know, preparing, like, what can I do to keep going? I'm like, maybe this town I can get like a smaller tire, so I get better mud clearance, so I can, you know, make some more distance than I am right now. And then they had canceled the race, or not canceled it, but they said, we're stopping and we're restarting farther south out of the muddy area, you know? And I find this out. So I was like, okay, at that point, I'm like 12 hours ahead of the second place guy. And then they're like, okay, we're restarting in the south. Everybody's going to get transported there, and then we'll all start again together.
Oh, that had to be disheartening.
Well, it was tough, but then I liked the guys I was riding with.
Okay.
So I was like, well, you know, I just worked so hard to get there, but then, you know, I did it. And then for the second, so I finished the first half well in the lead. The second half, I finished second. To a guy that I really liked, Neve. But, you know, it's like, then you're like, well, what's the point of it? You know, it's like, you're trying to win, but then you're like, well, I still want to be out there. And then it's like, well, does the result still matter at all if, like, somebody's changing the rules along the way and, like, truncating the race? I don't know. But I'm still happy I was out there. But, you know, it's hard to sacrifice so much and then have people just kind of take it away from you.
Yes, absolutely. So what was the total distance that you rode that first race?
Probably ended up being about 650 miles or so.
650 miles for your first race. And then a year later, you win the 4,200 mile Trans Am race.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that's true.
That's quite a start into the profession.
Yeah, I guess so, but it's all the same, you know, you just keep going. I mean, 600 miles versus 4,000, there at that point, what's the difference? It's like your lifestyle is just being out there. And then it's like, how long can you do it?
You know? At what point did you realize that, hey, I'm pretty good at this, and I should keep doing this?
I mean, I had done one other race the year before, and this was in Alaska, but it was not self-supported. So it was a 400 mile road race called the Fireweed 400, and it's a qualifier for a race across America. And there's a cutoff time of something like 36 hours. But I had been riding all over the state, borrowing my mom's road bike. My friend was like, "You've been riding so much, you're ready for this." So I entered and I did it, and I finished in 27 hours. And I didn't even know I could finish that distance. So then I was like, well, that's when I knew that I could just keep going basically forever, you know? And then it's like, once you like realize that, it's like, well, what's, you know, what is the limit really? And then I guess, you know, I'm always curious to find it, because every race, it's going to be something different. You know, you're stuck in the mud, or I've had problems breathing, or the severe heat in the Trans Am. It's always something different. So then it's like, well, you know, find the limit for that race and then deal with it, I guess.
It's, yeah. I want to come back to that thought. I want to come back to that thought in just a second, but I want to ask first, is this now your full-time job? I mean, do you have another career and you fit in biking around that, or is ultra endurance bike racing your full-time career and you've got sponsorships?
Well, yeah, it is. Biking is definitely my full-time job now, but it's not just the racing. It's like, basically, at this point, I make a schedule of all the things, like my dreams for the year. And then I'm like, hey, this is what I want to do. And then, you know, sponsors say, wow, that's, we want to help with this part, or we want to help with that part. And I try to keep like a balance of different kind of ambitions. It's like making a route entering a race or travel or, you know, a different program, just because like, if it was only racing, it's really taxing physically to do the races. And it's only so much fun to load them on. You know, it's like, yeah, after a while, it's like, okay, great. I can ride 200 miles a day for 2 weeks. Like it's not exciting after a while. It's like, that's like a job. So then I'm like, well, what could I do? Like, it's always, for me, it's always important to have something to look forward to, something to be excited about. But yeah, it's my full-time job to do that. And then before that, I was just working at restaurants and bike shops to pay for it. So I feel so fortunate that I just actually get to focus on what I like. You know?
Lael, what's your secret? Because the beginning of every year, I make a list of all my dream activities that I want to do. And I go look for sponsors, and I can't find anybody who wants to help sponsor me on my adventures.
I guess I just did it for, you know, a decade before anybody offered anything. So maybe
persistence. And yet you're really good. Yet you're really good at it.
Keep doing it.
Got it. Tell me about your first sponsor. What was that experience like?
My first sponsor is Revelate Designs, that make bike packing bags. And they actually started sponsoring me before, or providing me equipment before, I was racing, just because I rode so much, you know. And then I guess I'm the ultimate gear tester for them, because it's like, I ride the amount in a couple months that somebody might ride in like 5 years. And so then they see like how the bags hold up. And I'm also like not that fastidious with my packing or with my cleaning or maintenance. I just kind of go. So then it's like, you see real wear and tear. And they're also based out of Anchorage, Alaska, where I'm from. So it's been really cool to work with them. I think it's been since 2012. And they also support the girls program I run. They give bags to these low-income girls, 12 and 13 years old, that I work with in Anchorage. But at the same time, it's like they started as a company in 2008, I think, basically right when I started riding, maybe a little bit earlier, maybe 2004. But it's a friend of mine, Eric Persons, out of his garage, who just started making bags. And he started, I think, because he was racing the Iditarod, or the Idita Sport. You know the Iditarod Trail? It's a 1,000-mile dog sled race in Alaska. Mm-hmm. But absolutely, now people race it on foot or on bike or ski. And so he was doing that, and he was making his own bags and realized nobody had bags. So then he's like, well, this is a need. But, you know, nobody expected that people would ever want to pursue bike packing. You know, at that time, it's like, it's just kind of a weird thing. So he started his own company, and then it just has grown so much. You know, it's like something people actually consider as like an adventure. You know, you go to REI and you buy bike packing bags. I mean, that just is like mind blowing, because before, it's just like, people are just you know, trying to strap a dry bag to their handlebars or something. They want to carry something or just wear a backpack. But yeah,
the world has evolved to these adventure athletes out there.
Yeah, I guess more people realize this is an option and something they want to do. So I feel like, especially with Revelé, we've kind of gotten to grow together to, you know, something that we like, other people actually like. You know, I never expected that to happen. Used to be if I saw somebody with bags on their bike in Alaska, I pretty much knew them. You know, and now you see, and now I see people riding around like, hey, I don't know that person.
It used to be a small crowd, and now it's a big crowd.
I hope so. I'm excited to see that, you know, it's like people want to be challenged because it's hard. Bikes are heavier with stuff on them, mm-hmm. you know, but it's also like a lot of freedom.
So you entered that first race with your $400 bike. Is that what you said? $400 steel frame bike. What have mm-hmm. you evolved to? What is your equipment look like now?
Oh yeah. Well, actually after that race, I bought my first fancy bike, which was Specialized at the time, a Stump Jumper hardtail. And I was like, oh man, this is like, it was a $5,000 bike. I got a deal at the shop. It was $3,000. And I was like, this is, you know, half the money I make in a year. And I was like, well, I'm going to race on this and then I'll sell it. And then I'll be okay. So I bought myself a Specialized, and then I raced the Tour Divide twice that summer. And then that fall, somebody from REI and Outside Magazine got in touch with me to do a time trial on the Arizona Trail. Arizona Trail is like a rugged hiking trail. I was like, well, I can't race that on this bike. I need like a mountain bike. And they're like, well, what's your ideal mountain bike? And I was like, well, a Specialized Epic. So they're like, okay, we can get that. And wow. Then since then I've been sponsored by Specialized, you know. And then gosh, they make the best equipment. You know, it's like these dream bikes, like that are made for racing for an hour, and then I just go race them for 2 weeks. But it's been really cool, you know, to take these like basically spaceships and then take them across the country.
So is it safe to say that $3,000 you dropped on stump jumper, that was the last money you spent on a bike?
No.
Well,
I don't know. Bikes are complicated. You know, you have to, like, they have a lot of parts on them that you have to constantly replace if you ride a lot, especially. You know, and this stuff is so expensive. I mean, like, but that's the thing. It's like, I do get a lot of help with components and equipment, but there's always something, you know. I mean, like, I started as a runner in like my first, I think, 7 years bike touring. I was like, God, this equipment's just killing me. You know, you think about the simplicity of just being on foot versus like maintaining a bike, and something could go wrong. But then it's also like the tool that could take you so much farther. And you get a rest, you get to descend, you know, it's like, there's so many benefits. But, you know, bikes, gosh, I always have to like have friends that are bike wizards, because like, I can't, you know, I don't know how all this stuff's going to work together, and it's constantly changing. And some people that's their passion. They love gear. But for me, I'm like, okay, what's going to work? But then it just keeps getting better and better. So that's not the last money I've spent on a bike. That's for sure.
All right. I thought everything was just handed to you by these sponsors. Sound like it was a sweet gig.
It is. But, you know, I guess it's just more equipment, more complicated.
Yeah.
You know, especially like you have to make sure everything works. But I am in a position where like I get to ride the best stuff, and it's so, so cool. You know, it's like amazing to ride these bikes, and they're always changing, and they're all these different disciplines. So it's like, I could be descending on like huge boulders, and then the next week I'd be like flying up a paved climb, you know, and the bikes are so different. And that's part of what keeps it fun for me too.
Right. So when you were a runner, how far, what distances did you run? Did you do marathon distance?
I ran a marathon right out of high school. So I started running my senior year of high school on the cross country team, mm-hmm. and I loved it. And then I had this idea, I want to run a marathon. So I did right after I graduated. And then I ran a bit in college. I think we ran the 6K. You know, I mean, I always wanted to run longer, but like the competitive distances are, you know, 5K, 6K, 10K. So that's what I did.
Right. And did the running regimen, your time on the pavement, did it translate well to same type of exercise on the bike, or is that totally different muscle set?
I mean, the thing is, it's like, I think I loved running more, but it's just so much harder on your body. You know, I'm actually really kind of happy that I got out of it, because it's like, I really got into endurance solo riding because I was injured running. I had an Achilles injury. I couldn't run. So I was borrowing my mom's road bike and riding farther and farther, just because I was like so frustrated that I couldn't run, because that was like my true love. You know, it's like, I was like mourning losing running. But then I realized I was really good at that. And it's so much easier on your body. You know, it's like, I mean, I'm 34 now, but running is just, it's an amazing feeling, but it's taxing for sure. You know, I don't know anybody that has like great longevity with running. So I'd say it's really similar. What I find the most similar is to running is standing up on the bike, which I do a lot of. It's like kind of the same motion. Mm-hmm. But I'd say they're pretty compatible. I'd say more talented runners should bike.
Okay.
Because I think they would find like exceptional results.
Nice. Okay. Now, you mentioned earlier about finding your limit, or finding your limit in a race. How much of a 4,200 mile race is physical limitations versus mental limitations?
Well, especially a self-supported race.
Yeah.
Because you have to make every decision along the way. You have to get water. You have to get food. You have to decide when to sleep, where to sleep. You know, how you're going to take care of yourself. You have a mechanical. During that race, I broke my seat post, cracked it. So I had to ride 50 miles standing up to get to a town with a bike shop to replace it. You know, I mean, like this kind of stuff is just going to happen. Flat tires, you know, then you're going to have problems. So I think it's both, because like you have to keep your mind alert, but you know, you're always doing physical work. It's like there's no easy moment, you know? So it's like, it's gotta be both. Your body has to hold up to that kind of distance. And so I think it's really both. But then it's like, that's the interesting part, is like, who's going to win? You know, at the end of the day, who's going to win? Who rides the fastest for the first 10 hours? You know, it's like, how many hours are there in 18 days?
Right.
You know, a lot more.
Yes.
So then it's like, well, who's going to win? And then that's like the kind of like spark of excitement is like, well, I show up next to like these guys. I was wearing like a Cotton Hanes t-shirt, and these guys are on like time trial bikes. It's like, well, which one's going to work better? Whoever wins, that's what worked better, you know?
That's right.
So it's like, that's the purity of it, is just, it's just the result. But I did have a great specialized bike. You know, I had this great road bike, and, but you know, that's, it takes so much to get there. So, I think it's definitely a mix. And I think more people are getting interested in this style of riding, because it's like, you're making all your own choices. You know, there isn't a team behind you. You don't have a manager. What do you do when you get out there? You know?
So let's go back to that statement by Bicycling Magazine, where they called you the fastest ultra endurance racer in the world. Does that definition mean that speed wise you are the fastest, or that you will put in the extra hours to go the extra distance?
I mean, I don't like that article at all. To be honest, they sent a woman up here to like kind of shadow me for a week, and she was really hard to deal with. And I was running a girls program at the time and working so hard, because that's so much harder than racing for me. It's like organizing, putting events on, like encouraging others. But it's something that I'm really driven to do, because it's like, I didn't know about this sport. If I hadn't found it, it's just so much by chance, you know? And then I'm like, well, this is a great opportunity for other people, not to compete, but just to be out there, to feel this freedom, to ride somewhere, to carry your stuff. So I do that. But then, yeah, bicycling sent up a woman that was just like, she was less capable than the 12-year-old girls I was mentoring, you know? And then she writes this article and I think it's garbage, but you know, that's how it goes. Whatever. I don't even know how to respond to fastest or whatever. But you know what? The thing is like, there are a lot of people with good results and that's great. You know, it's like find your own way in it. Do it because you like to. Work hard. Hopefully have some fun, you know, because if it wasn't fun, I wouldn't keep doing it.
Let me put it this way. So are you faster than most of the other racers out there, or are you just riding longer hours during the day to get the miles in?
Because I sleep like 4 or 5 hours a night.
Is that typical?
Then, you know, for me, some of these racers are like not sleeping for 2 nights and then sleeping a bit on the third.
Okay.
Some people are sleeping for 7 hours a night, you know, it's like but it is a lot about efficiency. So it's like, oh, okay, sleep's one thing, but then like, what about stopping for everything else? What about stopping to eat? I try not to do that. I just eat on the bike. Or when you stop to change layers, or you stop to kind of work on your equipment or whatever, you know, it's like a lot of it comes into time moving forward. But right. Because like when you look at the overall average speed, like for a 24-hour day, it could be like, you know, 10 miles an hour, which is not fast on a bike, but then it's like, well, you know, everything takes time, and especially time off the bike, then your speed's zero, you know? So it's like, I mean, that's hiking. It's like, you can't stop moving or you'll never get anywhere.
Yeah.
Hiking's like so much harder.
We had a couple of guys on the pod a few weeks ago, Gabe and Kevin, and they fast packed the John Muir Trail. So they did 211 miles in 6 days. And they both had run the Moab 240. So they were ultra endurance runners, and they had in their minds before coming onto the trail that they were just going to run the John Muir Trail. Cause Gabe's wife said, "Hey Gabe, you've got a week to do this." And so he said, "Okay, well, we better try and do it fast."
Fit it in. Yeah.
So he said, "Okay, we'll show up and we'll run the John Muir Trail and we'll be done quick." And they got there and realized that the terrain would not allow them to run the trail. And so they had to shift their plan from trying to be speedy on the trail to putting in 18-hour days and hiking longer than anybody else. And they got it done in six days. So that was kind of what I was looking at with this quote about the fastest ultra endurance racer, if that meant that you were physically faster than everybody else, or you just have the mentality to put in the hours and get the miles in.
I think everybody is doing that though. Anybody that's riding more than a single day event, which is typically more than 400 miles, it's like, it's so much about time on the bike, you know, and like a 400 miles, like you can ride 400 miles in a day and you have to ride like a pretty decent pace to get that done. But then beyond that, it's like, it's always like, especially if you're taking care of your own needs, it's like a compromise, right? I mean, people do race across America where they have like 2 sport vans and they have people keeping them on the bike. But the interesting thing is they're actually not that much faster. How is that? You know, what's happening there? It's like, aren't you, but it's like, that's because people aren't just like robot machines. Like you have needs. You have to get off the bike to pee.
Right.
Like you pretty much have to do that. You know, you have to like,
that's a thing.
You have to change your shirt. You have to put a jacket on. Like all of this stuff takes time. And then, you know, like you're a good racer for so many different reasons, but one of them is because you're a multitasker. You're efficient. You know, you have to be. There's no other way.
So you're more efficient. You're a multitasker.
Everybody is. That is in the top 10.
And you keep saying like. You keep saying everybody, but you know, you did win this thing called the Trans Am race, 4,200 miles.
Right. But I wasn't a good road racer at the time. And that's, you know, 4.5 years ago, I just did it. I mean, gosh, it was so hard, but I've gotten faster since. I'll tell you that.
All right. Very good. Hey, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about how I stumbled across your story with the Ruta Chingaza short documentary. We'll talk about that a little bit. And then I want to get into the nitty gritty of this Trans Am race because it is just mind boggling to me. So stay tuned. We'll be right back after this.
I'm Lil Wilcox. I'm an ultra endurance cyclist, and you're listening to the John Freakin' Muir Pod.
And welcome back. We're talking to Lael Wilcox about her ultra endurance biking experiences. And we want to get down to this little short doc that I saw called, it was about Ruta Chingaza. Is that the correct pronunciation?
Yep.
Okay. Tell us about that a little bit. Tell us about that documentary and what it's based on.
Yeah. So that documentary is about a project with us, and us meaning me and my girlfriend Rue, and Conservation International and bikepacking.com. So Conservation International pitched a project to design a bikepacking loop to kind of show a conservation corridor. And this was globally. It was four young people from this organization, which is the biggest conservation nonprofit in the world. And they said, well, we want to make a route because if people ride their bikes through conservation areas, they'll care about the land, they'll learn things, they can do it on their own. That's the best way to kind of get a feeling for a place. They got this grant and they asked bikepacking.com to make a route. And the whole idea was to make a route that would take people about a week to tour. And then along the way, they learn. And then bikepacking.com asked Rue and I to come on board to make a video about the project. Rue would shoot the video and edit it. I would be there to kind of increase exposure for the route and the project and the story, and then people would be excited to come ride it themselves. So that's what we did. So we spent 6 weeks in Colombia in January and February, right before all the COVID craziness started, mm-hmm. For us anyway. And then we spent that time there. It was our first time in South America. And we got to ride and verify the route, meet locals, and then make it all happen. So that was the premise of the project. Part of it too was that I would go back after scouting the route and touring it a couple times. I'd go back and ride it all in one go to set an FKT. So I did that too, kind of at the end of our trip. And all of it was just so much fun. I mean, the thing with Colombia is that cycling is the most popular sport there, more than soccer, more than anything. Everybody rides. And I had no idea, you know, going into this place, I'd heard it was a great place to ride and, you know, beautiful mountains, but I didn't know that there was just this fervor, this excitement for riding. So to kind of be dropped into that, it was just fantastic, you know. And then Bogota, the capital city where we started, is at 8,800 feet. And then we just go up from there. You know, so we were riding up to 13,000 feet. It was humid. The whole route was designed to focus on how Bogota gets its drinking water. So it goes up high into Chingaza National Park, which is what the route's named for. And that's a specific ecosystem that captures moisture from the air, naturally filters it through the plants. And that's what provides drinking water to Bogota, a city of 10 million. You know, I mean, that's 80% of their drink water is natural.
Wow.
So our whole thing was to like focus on how important that is and how important that land is. And, you know, it's threatened by farmers, it's threatened by growth, but, you know, if they can keep it intact, they have water, which is at this point, of course it's always an essential resource, but, if you can keep it natural, that's just going to make this community thrive. You know, without a bunch of expense and without hardship, it's like, it's just there, you know? And so to be part of this project was huge. It was so cool just to see and to learn and to kind of connect with people. But, just that's the kind of the cool thing is like, of course I think conservation is great. And of course, like, I like this, but I'm not like, I don't have a lot of skills coming into this. And then just to be invited along, so cool to be a part of that and to kind of promote this idea.
And is that how you and Rouge met, or Had you met, did you know each other before that?
Yeah, no, we met in 2017. Rue was working for Alaska Dispatch News, the biggest newspaper in Alaska, and she pitched a project to her editor to make a video about a girls bike program that I was starting. So that's how we met. And then, you know, I never expected things to turn out this way, but how cool is that? There are more stories to tell, you know, more places to go, and it's cool just to kind of see where that leads.
So you two were a package deal on this. She was making the film, and you were doing the writing.
Yeah, but kind of, because I mean, really, we were invited on the project, but there wasn't a budget for a video.
Oh, I see.
So they just asked us if we wanted to come and if we thought the story was worth sharing. And then I found funding through my sponsors. So I asked them, because I was like, hey, this is a really cool story. Do you want to fund a video about this? So I asked Wahoo, which makes bike GPS and trainers, and Pearl Izumi, my clothing sponsor, and Wheels Manufacturing, which is a small made in US components company, and Komoot that does mapping, if they wanted to put up some money to make a video happen. Conservation International had money to fund our plane tickets and expenses. So, I mean, it was really us that asked, but I think that's kind of the thing now, is like the direction of marketing is storytelling, which is so cool, because it's like you tell real stories that actually mean something. And like, yeah, you wear this, you know, this specific outfit, or you use a specific computer, this specific bike, but like, we're actually doing something that we really care about. Brands, they like people from the brands, they feel inspired by that this is actually happening. And then it's like, yeah, let's make it work. You know, and that's actually how I got into sponsorship in the first place. It was all about media. Mm-hmm. It's like, you can do the coolest things in the world. You can like be the fastest person to cover every continent, but if you don't have any photos or any video about it, it's almost like it never happened. And I've done that too, like with zero media. And like, yeah, I had a cool experience, but I couldn't share it. You know, there's nothing behind it beyond like me telling people face to face, like, hey, this is what I did. It was really cool. I can describe what it all looked like, you know, but it's different if there's a photo of it. It's like, that just carries so much more weight. So working with Rue, I mean, she's a professional photojournalist. She went to the best school in the country for that. She has amazing skills, and like, and you know, to be able to share that, to be able to share my experiences through that is like, what a huge gift. And then, you know, sponsors love it because it's real, you know, it's mm-hmm. like, well, yeah. So I think the change is really good. You know, you don't have to advertise in magazines anymore. You can tell real stories yourself. There are platforms to do it. It's great. I mean, podcast, you know, mm-hmm. it's like, how did that happen? You know, and now it's like anybody can start their own and share important stories without having to, you know, have a bunch of funding behind it.
Right. Now, Ruta Chingaza, you said that you scouted the route. Is that code for you helped create the route? I mean, were you, I thought I read or saw that you were instrumental in creating that 261 mile route.
Yeah. You know, not from afar. I got invited into this project in December, and then we traveled there in January. So Logan Watts, that main editor from bikepacking.com, had a preliminary route design from afar. Mm-hmm. He lives in North Carolina. And then we traveled down to Bogota, met there, and started writing it together. So then it's like making sure that the route's good. If you have to change things for private land, or because, you know, it's not as beautiful as you wanted it to be, doing that together, kind of verifying routes. But really, the biggest help we had were from local Colombians to help us make a good route in and out of Bogota. It's hard to route in and out of a city of 10 million. You know, that's most complicated. That's where the most traffic is, the most roads are, you know, it's extended complication. Like Alaska, there are only so many roads. You can make a route in 5 minutes. There aren't other options. But when there are more options, like, you need better help to make the best possible route. So that's what we did together. So I think really a big piece for me was making local connections, meeting these people, finding out, you know, what are their strengths? What are they? And then it's so fun with biking because they're so passionate about what they do. You know, it's like the main guy that helped us is Juan Pablo. He has, I think, 8 bike and outdoor shops in Bogota, but his real love is just getting out and riding. And then his father was a professional cyclist in, you know, the 50s. I mean, like, his cycling is in his blood. And so then he helped us because, like, he rides all this stuff, you know, every day. He grew up there. So, like, he can give us the best routes and take us out there and show us places. So that was kind of my bigger role, was like kind of more being the link to the place. And then also for him, it's like he wanted me to meet the locals and talk with them and inspire them to get out and ride, because Colombia is a place where there's a history of fear and violence. People are not used to the idea of camping. They're not used to being like away from their place at night. Like, they're, you know, they're afraid. They're like drug issues and communist guerrilla issues and instability, but things are changing. So it's like he wants, you know, that's what I could bring in, is like encouraging locals to try this stuff, because things are actually very safe now, but they're like, are they really safe? And then it's like, well, if I go do it and they see it's okay, then maybe they'll go do it. So that was more my role, was like showing that this is possible. But it takes both sides, right? Everybody has their different skills.
Right. So your average avid bike packer in Colombia, how long would it take that person to do the 261-mile route with, I think it's 31,000 feet or more of elevation gain? What would be the average duration for your average person there?
We recommend a week. That was the total, that was the design. It's like a week, you know, because people could take a week vacation and do it.
Right. And you went out and you set the FKT and you did it in much less than a week, didn't you?
39 hours.
39 hours, less than 2 days.
Yeah. It was really hard. Super steep there.
I bet. Yes. And does that FKT still stand?
It does. But the problem right now is that the national park that the route goes through is closed. With COVID, it's closed. Before, right, it was closed because we have to get permission from but this is a cool part of the project too, is that we're working with this national park to allow cyclists to travel through. And it's something that they want to do, but they want to have like a good system to set it up. You know, I mean, that's always the tricky part. Where are bikes allowed? Where are they not allowed? Mm-hmm. You know, even in the US, it's not always a given. Horses are allowed more places than bikes are.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Like the whole Pacific Crest Trail, allowed on horseback, not allowed on bike.
Yep, that's true. Absolutely. So let's segue back to America. Let's talk about this 2016 Trans Am race. So it started in Oregon. Mm-hmm. Tell me, what does the starting line look like? How many entrants are there in this race? How many competitors? And is it like a green flag? They wave the flag and everybody's off? Or they fire a gun to get it going? Or what's that all like?
I think it was like, I don't know, it's probably like 160 people starting.
160 people crazy enough to do this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then thousands and thousands more that tour it every year, because it's an established touring route. So, and then I think we had like a 4-mile neutral start to get through town. And then you're just off to the races.
Okay. And do they have a time limit? Do you have to finish this race in a certain number of days, or is it just open until you cross the line?
A really great guy. Gosh, I wish I could remember his name right now, but he's the first time we raced the Trans Am, he finished in like 100 days. I think he's like maybe 70. And then the next year he was like, well, I'm going to race it again, but I have a goal to finish in 90 days this time. But then I think maybe he didn't finish in 90 days because he stopped to do some field work along the way or something like that. You know, but he's like a really great character. He had like bought this Transamerica bike route book, and then he was carrying it on the race, and he was having like everybody he met along the way sign it and like write a note, kind of like a yearbook. I wish I could think of his name, but what a great character. You know, it's like, yeah, you could tour it or you could race it, or you could be like him and tour it in the race and like make an event out of it and carry a spot tracker. And like every town he went to, he had super fans. They were like so excited he was out there, you know, and that's so cool because it's like he's doing it and like people are that don't have the ability to ride that. It's like he's their hero, you know. So no cutoff. You know, so, some of this stuff, it's like there's a cutoff of like fastest time plus 50%. But most of the time, it's like, you know, how many people are there? 160? Who cares how long they're out there? It's fine. Whatever. They can do whatever they want.
That's like somebody waving the starting flag down in Campo, Mexico for the opening of the Pacific Crest Trail season. And everybody gets there at their own pace then, right? Is it really, you're just kind of racing yourself in that particular race.
Well, I wanted to win.
You wanted to be the first one to go from Oregon to get to.
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
Was it?
I mean, like
it ended in Virginia. Is that what you said?
Yeah. It ends in Yorktown, Virginia.
Virginia. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean like, yeah, of course you're always racing yourself, but somebody's got to be first.
Well, in my mind, you know, as leading up to this podcast, I'm thinking 4,200 miles, Trans Am race going across the country. In my mind, I visualized Lael just battling it out with other competitors neck and neck for 4,200 miles.
That's how I finished though.
Really? It was that tight of a
finish? Yeah. I mean, so I was chasing this guy the entire way, Stefan from Germany. And I caught him in the last night at like 3 a.m. And and then we're like neck and neck racing for, you know, 25 miles. And then it's amazing. Like, it's amazing what you can actually, you're like dead tired, sleep deprived. The final 3 nights I slept a total of 6 hours, but then like you get this jolt like of adrenaline and then you can just go, you know? So we raced. I mean, and then, okay. So the story is like, he asked me if we could just finish together, and because we'd been racing for so long, and I was like, are you kidding me? Like if you were like 20 miles ahead of me, you wouldn't wait for me to show up. I was like, no way. And I love racing, you know, it's like, I guess that's the thing. It's like people love racing or hate racing, but I think it's not a negative. It's just so exciting to be out there. It's like, I want to do my best. I want to win. Like, and if I don't, it's fine, but it's like exciting just to be there and do it and give it everything you have.
Okay. Now, Lael, you have to give our listeners the dramatic description of this finish. How far behind were you? How long had you been chasing him? When did you catch him, and how did it go to the very end? I want blow by blow detail on this.
Oh man, it's just too much though. It's too much because it's like, okay, so I mean like up until like the halfway point of the, or you know, it's a 4,000 mile race. The dynamics are incredible. Like the first 1,000 miles, I'll tell you, is like Stefan Stransky and another woman, Sarah Hammond from Australia. They were like neck and neck, like killing each other. Maybe the first 1,500 miles, like they were only sleeping like an hour or less. And then, you know, they were just like going after each other every day. Stefan would like get Sarah, and then Sarah would come back and get him. And then Sarah at one point, like they were so sleep deprived that she missed a turn. Cause it's none of this stuff is signed. It's like, you just follow your GPS, and she missed a turn and went 40 miles in the wrong direction. And then didn't realize, and then had to ride 40 miles back to get back on course. Meanwhile, she rode out 40 miles, back 40 miles. I was still behind her. I was like, oh, that's so embarrassing. This person is like, goes the wrong way, comes back, and then she's still beating me. I was like, oh man. And at this point, like I had never ridden with anybody really like in the past. And the But then I had the same pace as this other guy, Evan. So then we're like riding together more or less for a week. And then, you know, Evan was like cracking. I didn't have a smartphone, so I couldn't see where anybody was. I had no idea, but Evan did. So he checked like the tracker and he's like, he would make jokes like, well, Sarah's in Virginia, you know, like she's like going to kill us. And then he told me she went off route and then she came back. And then we're like, we're still behind, you know, just like plodding along, but sleeping like 5 hours a night. Cause you kind of have to, I don't know, to like maintain sanity. But then Evan was like, Sarah, we're catching her. Like we caught her in Colorado and then we catch her. We ride with her for an hour or so. She's super, super out of it. I think she's an amazing rider, but she definitely dug herself in a hole there. And then at that point, we're like getting into Kansas and we're, Evan and I are second and third. And then the leader, Stefan, is in first and he stopped sleeping at all. Because he was like, I think because he was so worried that I was going to catch him. You know, he's like, he can't be beaten by a woman. She's coming. And then fans would tell me that he would like, they're like, oh yeah. You know, I'd be at a gas station buying chocolate milk and somebody would be like, Stefan's asked, where is she? You know, like he was like hounded. And I was like, oh, that's terrible. But you, I was like, I'm just going to get him.
You took up, you took up residence in his head. You were living there rent free.
Well, yeah. It's hard to be out front. It's really hard, you know? So I'm like, because if you're behind somebody, you're like, oh, well, they're just there. I'll do my own thing. But if you're in the front, you're like, what are they doing behind me? Are they going to get me? You know, it's hard to be the leader. It really is. Anyway, yeah, after Kansas, he stopped sleeping past like cat naps, you know, like 20 minutes at a time or whatever. But that's only like halfway into the race. You have like another 2,000 miles to go. You know, that's like a long time to catnap. Then I was just like kind of gaining on him and then he'd be ahead because he rode so much longer. But then, you know, I get to kind of towards the end and I'm riding with Evan and we both want to catch this guy. But then Evan is like falling asleep on descent in Kentucky. And then the real story about this race is that the eastern portion is just so much harder than the west. Like you think the west is going to be hard because there are all these mountain passes and climbs, but the east is just like choppy up and down, kind of like the Appalachian Trail. Like it's just like punchy and hard, relentless. But then that's actually when I kind of came into, you know, like what I can actually do. Like I'm a great climber. That's what I can do. You know, this road riding, flat terrain, it was horrible for me, but I could climb. So then I'm catching this guy and then I realize like, okay, well, I have to start cutting sleep to actually try to make it go to catch him. So then like 3 nights out, I sleep, you know, 2.5 hours, 2 nights out, I sleep another 2.5 hours. The final night I sleep like 20 minutes and then another 10 minutes. And I'm like, I'm going to catch him. And then I'm riding along, you know, the middle of the night, Evan had fallen asleep. So he had on a descent, he had had to stop and go to a hotel, which sucked because I wish we were together for that. But then I'm gaining, you know, ground. And then I see this light coming back towards me. And I was like, whoa, who is that? 3 in the morning. And it was, and then I see this guy with like a bike and all the gear. And I was like, what is that? Like a fan or what? But when he sees me, he turns around and starts riding with me. And I turn and look at him and I was like, what's your name? And he told me, Stefan. And then I realized that's the guy I'd been chasing. And he had been so out of it that he had woken up and started riding backwards. He rode like, you know, over 4,000 mile race. He woke up, started riding backwards. I think rode like 10 miles backwards.
Ooh.
And then saw me and then started riding the right way. And then he told me his name. And then I was just like, I just took off and then I'm just sprinting like crazy. And then we're like going down the roads and, you know, it's the middle of nowhere. It's totally dark. And then, there's a split in the road. We'd been riding for like 10 miles already, just sprinting, not talking. And then I take a right and he's like, no, it's to the left. Like that. Cause it's like, no, this stuff's signed. Like everybody makes tons of wrong turns. And so then he kind of like waits up as I catch him and he's like, let's talk. And I was like, well, he kind of waited for me. So, okay, we'll talk. And then he's like, we've been battling this out for 2 weeks. Let's just finish this together. And I was like, together? No way. This is like the best part. I can't believe we're actually racing to the finish. So then I just take off and then he's like with me. And then every time he catches me, I just go harder and harder and harder. And then, you know, like after like over 20 miles, 25 miles, I look back and I realize that I dropped him, you know, and then he was gone. And then I get to the next town. Like, it's all, you're always looking for towns to fill up water, get food, whatever. And then I get to the next town, but on my way in, like I have electronic shifting on my bike and it died. So then I'm like, okay, well, I could just single speed like that. The bike still works, but it won't shift gears. So then I'm like, I could just single speed to the end because I don't want him to catch up with me because this guy's behind me. And then I was like, well, I have to deal with this. It's not fast enough. I need gears. So then I'm like, well, I have to hide somewhere because if he sees me, then he's going to realize that I have a problem. And then he's going to get like energy and he's going to go. So then I'm like, I hide behind a gas station. And then I'm like trying to like figure out my electronic shifting. I can't get the battery out. I have like a spare battery. I connect it. I shove them both down my down tube and I like keep going. And then I have 100 miles left. And I was like, all right. And then I realized like what a burden it is to be the leader because I was like, he's behind me. And then you're just like freaked out about who's behind you. And I was like, and then I'm paranoid. I'm like, no glass in the road, no flat tires, no problems. Like you have to be consistent. So that's what I did, you know, and then I ride to the finish, like 17 miles an hour average, get there, finish. And yeah, then there's like a group of like 20 people to cheer me in. It's Yorktown, Virginia. So they have like Civil War reenactments, like little kids playing flutes and it's super weird, you know, and I'm like already delirious. And then, I waited for him at the finish and he came in like 2 hours later.
So you won the 4,200 mile race just by 2 hours, overtaking him in the last, 125 miles?
Yeah.
That's incredible. I would pay to see that movie.
It doesn't exist.
When are they making the movie?
I know, right? But then if nobody's out there documenting, it doesn't exist. That's the sad part.
Oh, it exists. It exists right here in my mind now. That was a wonderful rendition.
I know. It's too bad. The race director on that one was out there in the Saturn taking photos. And he looked worse at the finish than the rest of us. I mean, that's a long time to be out there. You know, the fastest person is 18 days. And then you're supposed to, you know, at least pay and wait for the 90-day guy. But he probably waited for another 10, 12. That's the thing about these races. They get so spread out that it's like people are in different states at a certain point.
So in covering that, those 4,200 miles, there had to be many epic moments on the trail. Can you boil it down to a top three, just a quick list of top three epic moments on the Trans Am race?
Yeah. Early along, because it was a heat wave, I realized the best thing for me was to totally submerge my body in water as much as possible. So I would like jump off my bike with my shoes on and like jump into creeks, get under like spigots, anywhere I could find water. I would just like soak myself because that's the only way I could cool down. That was a big deal. It was so hot and sunny that my skin peeled off my arms twice from sunburn.
Ouch.
And it had blisters and I had a huge crack in my lip and, a lady at a convenience store gave me chapstick for free.
Is that one of the top three epic moments?
Yeah. I mean, that was the real experience. Breaking the seat post was good. You know, once I got a flat tire and I don't know. The people that like these nice folks in Colorado were like, she looks like she crashed, but she said she just got a flat and it was just what I looked like. You know, I look so bad. I mean, I don't know. You know, it's like you ride through Kentucky. And I don't think I would have ever gone there otherwise. It's amazing. It's amazing to see the country like that. You know, I don't know if any moment is that special beyond just like being out there and seeing what you see.
All right, I'm going to pin you down. Favorite state you saw that you rode through on the Trans Am?
Favorite riding was Missouri.
Missouri. Wow. Why?
Yeah. Like a roller coaster, just up and down so, so hard through the Ozarks. It was like incredibly hard riding, but also so fun at night. Cause the thing is you always have to ride through the nights. But you can't see cause it's dark. You know, I had pretty good lighting, but I would just look at my GPS to see the turns in the road and then be like, okay, it's going to do this because you're so freaked out. And then you can't see far ahead. And then I'm like, I hope there's nothing in the way, like a big like stick or something that'll take me out. I mean, it was just, that was wild just to like descend in the dark. It's like your stomach is just going to go like up into your chest. Crazy. But I did like the riding there. It was just more fun than kind of flat Kansas was pretty tough.
Well, that was an epic story about the Trans Am. Thanks for sharing that with us. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to hear about the Baja Divide, the bicycle shop, and what's next for Lael. So stay tuned for that. We'll be right back.
Hey, y'all. It's Brittany Woodrum, and I just completed climbing all 58 of Colorado's 14ers, and you're listening to the John Frickin' Muir Pod. Thanks so much for listening.
And welcome back. So that was quite the story about the Trans Am race, 4,200 miles, came in first place, men or women. You're the first place finisher overall, dramatic finish. How about the Baja Divide? What is that race all about? I understand that you were the co-designer of that and currently hold the FKT on it?
I don't actually.
Oh, you don't anymore?
A guy, I think a year or two later, Pete Basinger went back and beat my time by an hour and a half. Oh. So my time was 11 and a half days and he beat it by an hour and a half.
So where is the Baja Divide? How long is the race?
The route is 1,700 miles.
Okay.
And it goes from San Diego to San Jose del Cabo down the Baja Peninsula in Mexico.
Wow.
Yeah. And then there's a little loop in the Cape, but Baja is a desert. So it's this strip of land with water on both sides, the Pacific Ocean and the Sea of Cortez, and then a desert in between. But up high, there are oases. You know, like natural water sources, which are pretty incredible to see in a desert. But yeah, hey, so a bit of a backstory on the route. I had ridden down Baja. And there's only one road down Baja. It's the one. And I bike toured it in 2010. And it's really beautiful, but it's really narrow and it's really sketchy. To ride with traffic all around. And then, you know, even during this ride, at the time I was with my boyfriend then, and we were like, wow, there are all these dirt roads going all these different directions. How cool would it be to be kind of riding this dirt instead of riding the pavement? But we just had road bikes and our road touring bikes, and we tried to ride a bit of dirt, but it's really sandy down there. So it's just not a lot of fun if you don't have the right equipment. But then we came back, 5 years later, and this was after I'd gotten into racing, and the whole idea with the trip down to Baja was it was supposed to be resting. I'd already ridden, you know, I had ridden like 9,000 miles in 3 months before this trip. And I just wanted to rest. Like, I just wanted to get a job in a restaurant. I was broke. I was tired. I just didn't have energy or like, even I just didn't want to be on my bike, but my boyfriend then, he had been working all summer and he was like, well, I want to ride so we can just go down there it'll be short days on the bike. You'll rest a lot and it'll be just relaxing, whatever. But then within, so we tried to piece together a route for ourselves that was like just more dirt. We had mountain bikes, 3-inch tires, huge tires. And then within a week of just riding, we were like, this is so fantastic that we have to make a route here to share with other people. So that was the next, that was like the focus for the next 3 months of that year. And then 3 months of the next year was to buy a bike, scout and ride, you know, this full route. And we had to make 2 passes down the peninsula to get the best riding because there are always things that stop. And one of them was in the east side, there's a road through San Felipe and then it extends south of there. And it's just getting more and more paved. So then it's like, well, it's not as interesting of a ride if it's all pavement. So then we went back through and took it back to the West Coast along the Pacific. And there's a dirt road along the Pacific Ocean, you know, that you can ride on a bike, like a good Jeep road. And it's like for, you know, like people from California and the US, it's like, it made me think like, this is like California from 100 years ago, you know, like what a gift to be able to ride this, to see like the rugged ocean from your bike without anything being developed. So we worked, you know, basically 6 months and 2 years to put this together and then had a group start on the route where I think it was January 2nd, 2017, we had an open invite for people to meet us in San Diego to all begin to ride together. And there were 100 people there and we all started riding the route together, not as a race, just as a ride. And then people kind of leapfrogged along the way and then, you know, went down and did this ride. And then I went back, I think 2 months later to establish the FKT.
How cool is that to put that together over the course of 6 months or more and then invite others to come out and ride it with you and have 100 others show up and just enjoy, you know, what you have put together. That's incredible.
It was super cool. It was like people from internationally, people from Alaska, people from all over the world. And I had also hosted a women's scholarship to provide the bike and bags and camping equipment and everything you needed to ride this route at your own time for, and then so many women that applied for the scholarship but didn't get it still showed up for the group start and still rode the route. So then it was like, it was a lot of women out there as well, which was really cool. And we just had so much fun, you know, but I mean, to be honest, the process of organizing that was super taxing. I mean, this was pre-sponsorship at all. Like I was paying to be there. I was paying to put all this stuff together and it was a ton of work, but worth it. Just because you don't get paid doesn't mean it's not worth it, but it is definitely exhausting, yeah. You know, to like do that. So I'm glad I did it, but it was really, really mentally hard to do that. And then also to be worried, you know, because it's like people have this stigma about Mexico. Oh, it's not safe. You know, people can't go there. And then, I mean, Baja is kind of like Alaska. It's super remote. Yeah, maybe it's not safe because there's not a lot of water, but not because people are going to attack you. You know, it's just that's the kind of thing we were dealing with. It's like a lot of stress to encourage people to do something because you don't know how their experience is going to go. And so it was really tough but really cool to do at the same time, and the route's still out there, so you know, every year people are riding it, which is great. I haven't been back since 2018. I think I rode it 4 times, you know, in a year and a half. So I kind of got my fill.
Mm-hmm. Nice. It sounds gorgeous. Hey, let's go back up to Alaska where you are right now. And tell me a little bit about this place where you spend some of your extra time, your spare time working at the bicycle shop.
Yeah, I don't work there anymore.
Oh, you don't? Okay. I had read that you still, during the off season, kind of spent some time working at the bicycle shop, a little local place where you are. So.
Yeah, it's a great shop. It's the oldest shop in Alaska. The owner is, I think, like 75, and he still works 7 days a week in the summer, and it's a really cool spot. And then he would always employ me, you know, if I needed work or whatever. He would just, whenever I mean, so in 2017, I started a project to ride all the roads in Alaska. So we put a huge map of Alaska on one of the walls, and then, you know, I would just kind of stare at what roads I could ride. And he said, "This is just so great. You're doing this. Whenever you want to ride, go out and ride. And whenever you want to come back and work, come back and work." And that was like, I mean, really, that was my first real good sponsorship, was like somebody would actually pay me to be there when I was there and let me go when I needed to go. And that was super cool. They're a specialized dealer. So we've worked on events together. The mentorship program GRIT that I work on, they send, Specialized sends all the bikes to the shop and they help us build them up. We have our first meeting there. The girls get their bikes. So it's a good place. You know, bike shops are so necessary for communities, for service and for help. And I mean, this year there's been the biggest bike boom that's ever happened. They're in shortage. Everybody wants to ride. That's what's available. You know, it's like you go back to the basics of what can I do solo outside, and biking is like definitely one of the top things that is possible. So I'm happy to say that they're doing really, really well.
Good. Good. Hey, you mentioned GRIT. I think we've mentioned that a couple of times maybe, but tell us about GRIT, what it's all about, where you got your inspiration for that.
Yeah. So GRIT stands for Girls Riding Into Tomorrow. And it's a 6-week mentorship program I hold for 12 and 13 year old low income girls in Anchorage, my hometown. We meet 2 to 3 times a week to build up to a 60-mile, 3-day adventure ride at the end, from their school in Anchorage out to a Forest Service cabin. It's so cool. I started this with a friend in 2017, and she was down riding the Baja Divide, Kate Rodriguez, and we were just riding together talking about, you know, what we wish existed in the world. We worked together on a program to get bikes for my mom's 3rd grade class the year before. And I was like, "Do you want to do something like that again?" And she was like, "Well, I'd like to do something like that, but with focusing on girls and focusing on middle school or high school." So then we kind of pieced it together and have been doing that ever since. And Specialized provides entry-level mountain bikes for it, and Revelate Designs provides bags, but really we just have local volunteers to bring the girls out for rides and then also host classes on like fixing a flat and first aid and other things you need to do to prepare for the final trip. But these are girls that before they start, they have never ridden, you know, more than 5 miles. They're not athletes. And that's like the main thing. So I work with schools in the Anchorage School District, and teachers nominate the girls that aren't necessarily athletes, but are hardworking, would benefit from something like this, you know, are good with others. And so that's what we do. We usually work with 15 girls a year, and then they get to keep their bikes at the end of the year and come back as student mentors the next year. So it's been cool to see, you know, our first girls are now juniors in high school. They started as 12-year-olds. So it's been cool to see them kind of grow up and, you know, continue to bike. And I mean, that's the cool thing about biking, is it's a vehicle. It's a way to be outside. It's a way to compete. It's a way to, you know, be active, but it can be different things for everybody. You know, it's basically anything you could do on foot, you could basically do on a bike.
Yeah. I imagine they've learned a lot about themselves through that experience. And for most, I imagine it's really been a life-changing experience for them.
Yeah, me too. You know, to see young girls like take on these big challenges. I mean, the real motivation to start it was nothing like that existed for me when I was young. You know, it's like, I'm really happy that I played sports, but I never thought that I could bike. So then it's like, well, what if I found it earlier? Or what if they find it earlier? And, you know, they don't have to continue, but to take on a big challenge and accomplish it, that's something that works towards anything you want to continue with in life, mm-hmm. You know, so I think that's been fun to see, and different than the norm, you know. And they're 12. They can't drive a car yet.
Do you drive yet?
I have my license, but
oh, you did. Congratulations. You got it.
Thank you.
All right. What's next for Lael?
Going to Arizona on Sunday. Yeah. And then I'll be down there, based out of there for the winter. I'm doing a time trial on the Cocopelli Trail November 10th. So that's Moab to Fruta, Colorado, 140 miles with a friend. So excited for that, and you know, just excited to get down to the desert, warmer weather.
Hey, shout out to Fruta, Colorado. Mm-hmm. Shout out to Fruta, Colorado, because that is the town where we were on a cross country trip to take my son to a baseball tournament, and we ran out of gas, literally coming off of the freeway and cruising into the gas station there in Fruta, Colorado. So that was my experience with Fruta.
Cool.
All right. Hey, Lael, you know where we are right now?
Where? To the pro tip?
Yes, that's right. We're at the pro tip insight of the week. What bit of wisdom do you have to share with our listeners to make their next adventures even more epic or enjoyable?
Bring something good to eat. You know, bring real food, something that you're looking forward to having. I feel like people sacrifice food and then they bring other stuff that they don't really want or need. So that's a good one. Bring an apple. You know, you'll be happy to have it, eat it, and then that weight's gone.
That's right. That's right. Because, you know, through hikers, 2 days onto the trail, for the rest of the hike, all they do is talk about food and what they're going to eat when they get back. So I think that's an excellent, excellent pro tip. What are some of your top food items that you take with you?
Oh man, if I'm just touring on the bike, not racing, I'll bring tomatoes, cucumber. You know, in Baja, I was like, they had bags of refried beans. That was so good. Tortillas are great. You know, what else? I mean, gosh, every country has their own special thing. You know, bike racing in France, it's all bakeries and pastries. Lithuania, they have these great little cheesecake bars. I mean, that's the fun thing about this, about, you know, bike packing is like you are doing your own resupply, so you can just find the good stuff along the way. The U.S., it's a little more limited because it's mostly gas stations. In Colombia, it was little arepas, these cornmeal discs with sweet cheese in them. Whatever's there, I try to find the best of what I can get and something that I actually want to eat, because that's the other thing is like, you just have to eat a ton. That's kind of sad. You should always enjoy eating, but sometimes it's kind of gross.
Yeah. You're burning the calories. You gotta pack those calories in. All right, so there you have it. That's it. Episode 42 is in the books. I hope our listeners enjoyed our time with Lael, and I want to thank her for joining us this week. Lael, how can our listeners keep up with you on social media, and where can they find updates on your latest adventures?
Yeah, easiest is Instagram. So it's my name, Lael Wilcox.
Very good. Remember to check out the pod on social media as well. We are on Instagram and Twitter. And if you have comments or clips you want to share, you can send it to me at johnfreakingmuir@gmail.com. Also, if you're enjoying the podcast, take just a minute, help us out, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you're not enjoying the pod, well, just go ahead and keep that to yourself. Right, Lael?
Or you can say.
That's a wrap from the John Freaking Muir studio. Any final thoughts?
I think that's it.
That's it. Okay. Thank you for tuning in. Always remember, the trail is the trail. It doesn't care if you want to go downhill. It doesn't care if it's almost dark and you're looking for a campsite. It doesn't even care if you're at the end of a 4,200-mile cross-country race, 125 miles from the finish, and you're chasing down a guy named Stefan. The trail is the trail. Embrace the suck.
Brave anglers search for the one they call king, but who will take his throne? Tune in to Waypoint TV's Battle for Silver, Saturday, May 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. Eastern. Presented by Abyss Battery. Waypoint TV.